Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Kreisman. I am so thrilled to be joined today by Dave Eggers, who is the author of many books, among them The Circle, The Companion to the Every, and also The Monk of Mocha, A Hologram for the King, What is the What, and The Museum of Rain. He's a co-founder of 826 National, a network of youth writing centers, and Voice of Witness, an oral history book series that illuminates the stories of those impacted by human rights crises. Dave, it's so wonderful to talk to you today.
Nice to be here.
Dave, your latest novel, The Every, is available in hardcover from McSweeney's on October 5th, and it's only available for purchase from indie bookstores and McSweeney's.net, not Amazon. Tell me about the decision to give indie bookstores the exclusive.
Well, McSweeney's is a little publishing company that would not exist without the support of independent bookstores. Back in the day, I lived in Brooklyn in 98, and that's when McSweeney's started. And back then, I used to just bring boxes of the journal, like issue one of this quarterly, on the subway, and go from bookstore to bookstore to say, here's this thing, do you want to carry it? And even then, the difference between the human-to-human personal decision-making that an indie could do and the sort of corporate, centralized, dehumanized way that the chains and other, you know, places like Amazon handled things was that difference was so stark and so well, it's dispiriting when you were trying to, you know, distribute a little journal through those channels. And so back then, it just became clear that the only way that we were going to exist and continue was through this symbiotic relationship with indies, where we could call them on the phone or walk in and talk to a real person and say, can you handle this book or will you carry this journal? And yeah. So now it's almost 25 years that we've had this relationship. And this book, The Every, is sort of about the power of monopoly.
Yes.
And what happens when we continue to empower monopolies. And so it seemed to me an opportunity to maybe direct customers back to their independent bookstore, especially after this pandemic when the power of Amazon and other monopolies has only grown stronger and I think more potentially catastrophic to retail biodiversity.
I love that the protagonist in The Every has coined the phrase benevolent monopoly to describe The Every, which is a company that's sort of like, what if something like Facebook acquired an unnamed e-commerce giant, something like Amazon, and they melded together? And that really struck me because one of the things that I do a lot is encourage people to shop at indie bookstores and for them to be patient, especially now during the pandemic. And always there's someone who says, but Amazon puts their customers first and they provide the best service and they feel like Amazon is doing them a favor. And we value convenience so much, so often, over the stuff that really matters.
Well, and you also have to start with, maybe we break out books first and say, Amazon has never been a bookseller in any way that they actually care about books. It's another product, and they sell them under cost. You know, they sell them for wholesale, basically.
Yeah.
So they're undercutting all the indies that cannot do that because their profit comes from, from charging the cover price for the book, as they should. And so Amazon loses money and has always lost money on the sales of books so that they could acquire customers and push out independent booksellers and other competitors. So that's predatory pricing,
which
is not ethical or legal, really. And so it's subject to antitrust laws, and they should have been regulated 20 years ago. And just to say, listen, you have to play by the rules. You've got to charge the price on the cover. You have to pay taxes in states where you operate, where they don't do these things.
Yeah.
I don't know how, in God's name, they've gotten away with it for this long, but people have to know that if you're ordering books through Amazon, a lot of people are being hurt. The indies are being hurt, publishers are being hurt, authors are being hurt. And ultimately, if they continue to gain market share, it's going to be a cataclysm for the publishing industry and for authors. It's not good. You need people that care about books to be selling books.
Absolutely. And I see this supply chain crisis coming towards the book world. And I can see that people would think, oh, I should buy an ebook. And most ebooks that you're going to find, unless you really try, are going to be for the Kindle from Amazon. And there seem to be circumstances that make the easy option more and more appealing as things will get harder. And that seems like a perfect opportunity to say, okay, slow down. We have to make sure the indies survive.
Yeah, I mean, Amazon has done a brilliant job of acquiring all of these sort of secondary markets, like ebooks, the used books, they bought books, they own Goodreads, mm-hmm. all of these different aspects of the publishing industry. So pretty soon you're surrounded, including the ebooks. And it's very hard, like you say, it's very hard to put out an ebook and get it seen unless you're dealing somehow with the Kindle and with Amazon's distribution networks. And so, it takes a real effort to some extent to sort of work around them. And it took us so much effort. It's been so hard to distribute this book without them because everybody has contracts with them. So you do feel like that's what monopolies are all about, where pretty soon you actually cannot avoid them in some way because they've got their tentacles in every aspect of the business. And, but I do think, A, they should be regulated such that they cannot, that they have to, do their math the same way other people do. They cannot have their books as a loss leader supported by their cloud computing and other profit-making arms of their company. They have to play on a level field. And if so, then you're going to find more people. If you get the same price on Amazon that you do in indies, then that's fair. And maybe Amazon gets customers based on the fact that they can deliver books quickly. That's fair, fine. But they can't do both. They cannot undercut, they cannot lose money on every sale and call that fair play.
Yeah, it seems like in the past 25 years, say, the price that most consumers are willing to pay for a new hardcover has plummeted. Mostly because of Amazon's price cuts.
Right. It's created this totally artificial situation where we think that the cover price is just a starting part of a bargaining session where, really the price should be $10 below that and include free shipping if you're a Prime member, whatever. I find these practices just so unsavory, and I really sort of like a simple, the price is the price kind of economic system. And especially when it comes to a public good, which is the publishing industry, we need a wide and, free market. We need of ideas, and we need to be able to support new entries into that market and make it easy for them to get their work out there without always having to bow before one company. And the more the power grows, the more we're going to find it very difficult for new entrants to exist and to enter that market. And so I think that we can make a choice, though. There's still, 1,100 or so independent bookstores in the country.
Yes, yes.
In a lot of cities, they're all over the place. In New York City, we've had a real resurgence since the beginning of the century. And in San Francisco, obviously, we have so many. And so you just make a choice. Go in there and pay the price on the cover and say you're going to participate in an ethical marketplace and pay the price so that the publisher can pay their rent and the author can be paid properly and that we retain some sort of balance. If we continue to feed the apex predator in this situation, then that's all we're going to have. We're not going to have a wide diversity of stores and publishers and authors and all that stuff. We're going to be just feeding the one insatiable beast at the top, and that doesn't bode well for what I call retail biodiversity.
Yeah, I mean, watching Penguin Random House grow over the past decade, say, is worrisome. Like the idea that book publishers have to join together to tackle this beast by creating what is effectively close to another monopoly is scary.
That's a byproduct.
Yeah.
Of the empowering of one monopoly is that you have to create other conglomerates. You know, it's like King Kong versus Godzilla, sort of. You know, and there's and everybody else is running madly on the streets trying not to get stepped on. You know, it's. I think that we've got to, and it does have to start at the government level. They've been completely advocating their responsibility to monitor and enforce antitrust laws. And I think with Lina Khan in the Biden administration, I think that we have a better team than we've had for a while that might actually say, well, actually, we have laws on the books that we could easily enforce. And we have models for ways to do things. Like in France, for example, you cannot discount a book. You have to pay the cover price. The retailers have to do it. And it's so simple. It's like, why not just charge the price on the book? And then we can maintain, we can make sure that this public good, which is the publishing, printing, distribution of new ideas, is healthy. It's just that simple. Pay the price.
And of course, if you can't afford the price of a hardcover, which, I mean, fair enough, there's the library.
We do have libraries. They are they're right there. That's what they were meant for. And very often they're buying 10 copies of a new book so that everybody can get to them. But yeah, there are so many choices, and they rent ebooks too, So your choices are endless in terms of, supporting forces other than the one monopoly.
Yeah. Dave, let's talk a little bit more about the Every. Which it really feels like a zombie novel, just the way that The Circle did.
Zombie novel. I hadn't heard that. I want to hear more about that.
Oh, just when all of the good guys are coming together to take down the enemy, and then they're turned.
I like that.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
It's so believable that someone can be quote unquote turned, because we see it happen all the time in real life. There are so many things that Amazon specifically can offer. Like, there are literary organizations that are strapped for cash all the time, and getting a grant from Amazon would make a huge difference, like a couple thousand dollars. And you can't blame them for taking it and then depending on it. And yet, talk to me about the idea at the Every, where the people at the top really seem to have this absolute belief that they're making the world a better place.
Well, I don't know if it's just at the top. I think mm-hmm. it's run throughout. There's 10, 15,000 people working at this fictional company called The Every. And I do want to emphasize it is sort of, it's not based on any one company.
Sure.
I really want to make sure that I get to sort of write the book I want to write, as opposed to having it owe much to sort of the day-to-day functioning of the company that we have, any one company that we know. But yeah, in this book, Circle has merged with an e-commerce giant. So they've made this sort of, all-encompassing, all-collecting, all-aggregating and knowing company that also has a really powerful footprint in the real world, which boats, with shipping and planes and trucks and delivery systems and grocery stores. And so, I always want to emphasize, and I always try to do this with the Circle too, that most of the bad ideas don't come from the top. They come from the bottom or the middle or the newest employee or a company that this monopoly acquires. I've been in the Bay Area for 25 years, and I would say the vast majority of the worst ideas I've heard come from like a 26-year-old engineer who's hoping to sell their idea and cash in, sell their idea to one of the big five tech companies and cash in. I have heard just like the most gaspingly crazy ideas and invasive and privacy shredding ideas from the nicest, kindest, most normal seeming people who are reading the lay of the land, and they're saying, well, what's next? What might come next? What could I invent that might be sold to this company? And not necessarily thinking, what does the world need, or what's the right thing, or what's the ethical thing, but more like, where are things headed? Can I get a few feet ahead of the trend? Invent some app and then sell it. And so in the Every, there's this, our protagonist is Delaney Wells, and she goes into this company thinking that she wants to blow it up from within. But one of the ways that she does that is to think, like, I'm going to invent the worst ideas that I can possibly conjure.
It's a good strategy.
And I'm going to see if they'll be adopted by this company, disseminated by them, and definitely when they're out in the world, humanity will say, oh God, that's way too far. That's enough. I can't believe that you would do that. I'm going to leave you and your monopoly and in disgust. But again and again, that doesn't happen. She invent silly apps, like one where it will tell you if you enjoyed the meal you just ate, and people love it. And, it'll tell you if your sexual performance is up to snuff and how it compares to your friends and neighbors, and that one is embraced readily and used heartily. And she invents something called Friendly, that it'll tell you if your friends are trustworthy by it. Analyzing, dozens of data points and the tonalities of your voice and facial expressions, and posture, and that seems to be, that will be the bridge too far, but of course it's not. People love it. And so I think that my emphasis is always not really like, what do the tech companies do to us, but how do we respond? And how are we complicit? And when, if ever, will we say that's a line that we can't cross? And for the most part, there hasn't really been any resistance to any developments in the last 20 years, you know, which has been really interesting to see. There isn't anything where we've, I mean, every so often there's something. Google Glass got run out of town.
Yes.
Something. But now it's back. Facebook has their Ray-Ban sunglasses. And I think that, you know, usually these companies will do one run. There might be resistance. They take another run at it. 5-10 years later, and then by then the surrounding resistance has fallen away and you're just dealing with a few lunatic stalwarts who say that's too far, but humanity as a whole has gotten used to a level of surveillance that makes these cameras tolerable. So that's a long answer. I'm sorry, Matt.
No, that's fine. I mean, the other example of a failure that I like to invoke with book people is the Amazon book imprint that was supposed to be run like a New York publisher. Right. And the its failure gives me hope that there are still subjective qualities about good books that they are not able to capture through data.
For now.
For now.
I also was heartened by that failure. And back in the day, Barnes & Noble did their own, you know, editions of classics and stuff, and that was not a big success. The book publishing industry is full of incredibly dedicated people that are generally underpaid, full of bright young editors who are searching for the next new voice that, and it's like the mother lode, you know, if you find a new author that has never been published, or if you can rediscover an author who's maybe been, you know, underappreciated, you know, that's why that's why we all get up in the morning and read the submissions that come through the mail, or, you know. And that's the beauty of the whole publishing world. You know, it's just from top to bottom full of really people motivated by really the right thing. I get letters, you know, I got a letter yesterday from David Ebershoff at Hogarth Publishing, and he was publishing a new, you know, a young writer. He's published a book of poetry called Javier Zamora, who I knew as a high school kid here in San Francisco. And his letter about Javier's new book, Solito, was so passionate and so just like you felt like his whole heart and soul was in trying to get this book out into the world and to an audience. And, you know, the publishing world is just full of these people that that's all they want. It's like, how do you lift up this text? How do you get it out into the world? How do you send it off and, you know, give it an audience? It's worthy of it. And so it's I love the publishing world. I just love the people who work at every level of it, from the editors to the editorial assistants, to the copy editors, the designers, the salespeople, the booksellers. From top to bottom, it's just a good group of people. And so when that ecosystem is threatened, I get pissed off. And
same.
And if ever we there's fewer editors per book than there used to be. They're trying to cut corners wherever they can because the margins are slimmer every year. But so to maintain that world where the editors are paid to look for new voices, and that the whole, that the system can support these new voices. We have to make these choices about supporting them.
Yeah.
And paying the correct price for, not to belabor that point, but
yes,
the David Ebershoffs and Javier Zamoras don't exist without Hogarth and without these imprints and without their support system to say, all right, our job is to find and lift up new voices. And if we give all the power to a monopoly that doesn't have any editors and doesn't care about books and treats them like widgets, then that entire ecosystem, all of that infrastructure falls away.
Yeah. I also see in the book world that more and more publishers want to use data, want to make informed decisions based on numbers. And the best books, of course, have always been unquantifiable or haven't followed the right formula or wouldn't show up in the algorithm.
Right. Well, I have a whole chapter where
yes,
staffer named Alessandro, who's, you know, espousing all of the glories of algorithmic thinking to improve mm-hmm. books and all stories. And you see a little bit of it in the film world now, and you're going to see more of it when tech companies more and more are owning film studios. They can't help themselves but to use data to inform decision-making about, you know, how films are made. What do people like? Well, they seem to like beaches, so we're going to have more movies about beaches. This movie that took place in Baltimore didn't do well, so Baltimore's out as a setting.
Sure.
I mean, some of this has, you know, been in the film world beginning, but more and more, I think our worship and our endless faith in data is going to seep into what is, you know, what gets made. And I think, you know, I took it to a logical extreme with that, with that chapter where they're giving more power to AI to write books even and write the parts that don't need the human intervention. And to say, like, well, everything can be and maybe should be a formula. Why don't we follow a formula, give people what they want? And we can help authors by saying, according to our ebook research, people are putting your book down on page 123.
Yep.
What's on 123 that you could fix? You know? And because this data is acquirable, it will be used, you know? And there's never an area that's cordoned off by, you know, the tech world. They don't say, well, of course we shouldn't be getting ourselves involved in the humanity. You know, that's not our place. They always think that there's a technological solution or an improvement that could be made, or a tool that could use, that could be applied to an otherwise mysterious or you know, world, like what makes a book love, what makes people finish a book. Well, we will not know that.
No.
You know, we can guess at it, but that's not going to stop.
And the inclination to want to fix, quote unquote, Jane Eyre will live on in the tech world as long as, this is a side note, but I love that Alessandro calls them fiction novels, because that's a phrase that we definitely hear from tech people a lot.
Yeah, I hear it too. Did this happen or did this not happen? Why are they writing about things that actually didn't happen? Oh, I love it. You know, but it's just that, you know, I fight this this new trend toward grading student papers by algorithm. AI is increasingly grading student essays. And that's an area that should never have been entered by computers. It's so offensive and so inherently absurd, because these machines cannot read. They admit that they can't read. All they're doing is scanning for keywords. And yet because our faith in tech has grown by, you know, just unimaginable levels in the last 20 years, people don't even question the right of machines to grade students' papers. And I think the most disturbing thing of all is that on the other end, I think a lot of students would prefer it. And this is one of the big themes of the book. And this is where, you know, again, I'm always trying to think about what our, how are we complicit and how have we changed to where we're sort of meeting these larger powers in the middle. You know, we're not just oppressed by them because we're giving them a lot of power. And one of the things is that we're not comfortable with subjectivity the same way we used to be.
Yeah.
You know, students are like, well, what gives you the right to grade my paper? You know, what, you know, what, who are you to say that this is a B or a B minus? And why don't we have a fairer system? And a fairer system would seem to be AI that's objective and insentient and is just using a set of inputs and that we can all agree on. Did I meet word count? Is it five paragraphs? Did I do all of these things? Well, then give me the A, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like not just in that world, but in so many worlds, people are more and more uncomfortable with human decision making.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
I mean, I love the part in the book when Delaney proposes, or maybe she didn't propose. Let me rephrase. When Delaney encounters an app that objectively tells you what is beautiful, which is like just the most, yes, of course, the complete absence of subjectivity in deciding, you know, what is art and what makes you happy in favor of here are the numbers.
Right. I mean, I'm going to make you a bet and we can come back in 10 years somehow. And I'm going to say that in 10 years, you will see this exact AI system and you're going to see it applied in a lot of schools. I went to art school for a little bit and I know that there are art students walking among us right now that would vastly prefer an AI system to judge the merit of their work rather than some, you know, gray-haired painter whose work they don't like. You know, they would say, well, why do I have to submit to this person's gatekeeping? You know, why don't we have an unbiased system where it's just objective and we can judge the symmetry and color balance and composition and, you know, and there's just one set of rules that we all abide by. It's non-changing and without bias. And so, you know, increasingly we are ceding decision making to AI and to algorithms for profit on the one hand, because these things are wildly profitable to create, and but also because the people being judged sometimes prefer the purported accuracy and the perceived lack of objectivity. And I think that that's where I was trying to get at with this book is like, you know, we're changing so much as a species so quickly, and our faith in numbers and our hunger to have things numerified. You know, give me the quality of this book down to the hundredth decimal point, you know, and which, you know, is a system that exists out there, as you know, this book, the aggregated ratings of this book make it an 87.35. Now, yes. 40 years ago, this would be so far beyond dystopian fiction. Nobody would believe that people had applied a numerical system to the 100th decimal point, had judged the merit of books. And yet we think of it as just a democratizing and wonderful participatory system that we have. And of course, and we treat some of it with a grain of salt, but more and more we say, well, that's it. You know, this movie is in 87 and that book is 73. And we don't question whether it's right at all to apply a number to a wild, mysterious, ungovernable kind of thing like a novel.
And so with the Every, at least in the first month and a half, you are giving people the directive to go to their local indie and just talk to whoever they meet and ask them about what makes them excited. That seems like a great first step in remembering that the subjective can be gratifying.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I was in a bookstore a few weeks ago getting some books for a friend, and all I ended up doing was getting four books that had those little recommendation cards off to them, because I needed, I don't know, I just was like, I got caught up in the excitement of the booksellers writing about some books that I didn't know. And I think that there's something very calming and kind of appropriate, I guess, about sort of going into a store and it's just a handful of people that work there, and they could be doing other things. They could be trying to work at a tech company maybe and making 5 times, 10 times the money. But instead, they're in this sort of little haven of free thought and paper and glue and and humans. And they're there because they love one thing, you know, which is books.
I love that. And Dave, yeah. This is the logical time now then to say, do you have books to recommend to us?
Yes. You know, I always have to mention the books that we publish.
Of course,
we have a series called Voice of Witness, and there's a new book called Me Maria, narratives from Puerto Rican survivors of the Hurricane Maria, and it's an amazing book of oral histories that puts you right in the thick of the before, during, and after. And if you love Puerto Rico, if you love gripping stories, and if you were outraged by our governments, and the Puerto Rican government's reaction to the storm, then you have to read that book. I think that there's, no matter what you know on a subject, when you read a Voice of Witness book, you learn immeasurably from these first-person stories. We also published a book, McSweeney's, called Ivory Shoals by John Brandon, and came out a few months ago, and I think that there is no better writer of sentences today than John Brandon. This is a story that takes place right after the Civil War in Central Florida. There's a young boy living, raised by a mother who dies, and he goes looking for the father he never knew in a sort of a Huck Finn sort of way, making his way across the swamps of Florida to find this this man. And it's gorgeously written, and I just think John Brandon deserves every reader he can possibly get. I've never met anyone that didn't love his work once they discovered it.
Sounds wonderful. Dave, thank you so much. Be sure to visit your indie bookseller or bookshop.org and get your copy of The Every. And thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Maris. It's been great to talk to you.
You too. Safe travels.
Thank you for listening to The Maris Review. And check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.